Bashir is, I guess, somewhat provocatively titled, Did Abaye Have ADHD? So you may or may not know this, but I have ADHD. So the question of did Abaye have ADHD is, it's not just a... It's not just an academic question. It's not a question of, you know, diagnosing some long-dead sage with some sort of, you know, we call it a disorder. But it's a personal question of, like, okay, you know, if he did and he still made a contribution to, you know, to the development of halakha and to the development of the Gemara, of the Jewish people, of Jewish civilization, then that has implications, you know, personal implications, right? It's a different way of, you know, I can think about it differently. I can think of my own potential role in the culture of the Beit Midrash differently. And not only that, you know, we can ask the question of not only did Abaye have ADHD in the question of, you know, could he overcome ADHD, but is there really something to overcome? Or is Abaye... you know, did Abaye, is the way that he thinks, is the contribution that he makes to the culture of our learning tradition, is it a unique contribution? Is he thinking about things in ways that other Tanaim and Amoraim, is he relating to things in ways that other Tanaim and Amoraim weren't necessarily doing? And, you know, the question of whether or not this way of thinking, this way of, you know, this organization of one's mind is in fact something that makes a unique contribution, you know, to our tradition. You know, and obviously, I mean, I think right off the bat, you can tell that I'm somewhat biased in the direction of an affirmative answer, right? Yes, I think there's a lot to learn from this, and I think that, you know, if we can see what it means, right, if we can not necessarily diagnose or psychoanalyze, but if we can see Abaye in that sort of light, then it has implications for the way we think of, you know, for some of us, for the way that we think of ourselves, the way that we think of our children, the way that we think of our students, you know, the way we think of even our parents, right? My father, he wasn't diagnosed with ADHD. He was diagnosed with ants in the pants, right? My grandfather, he was diagnosed with Spielkes, right? So, but, you know, I was diagnosed with ADHD. My kids, so far, 3 out of 4. And, you know, I have a good feeling about the fourth. So, yeah, I mean, this is Talmudic, but it's also autobiographical, okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to learn 2 Gemaras, right? And then we're going to sort of meditate on them or, you know, and see other sources around those Gemaras that may... offer another, you know, sort of fill out our understanding here. Okay? This will come to the fore during the Shir, but, you know, for most of us, our experience with Gemara is that the Gemara is sort of split. It's bifurcated, right? There's halacha and there's agadah. There's the legal sections of the Gemara, and then there are the non-legal sections, the narrative, the exegetical. Basically, anything that's not legal is sort of lumped into that category of agadah. The truth of the matter is there are certain Gemaras that are really, really difficult, right, and to categorize as one or the other. For example, we have Purim coming up this week. The Gemara about Purim, you know, one of the most famous Gemaras about Purim says, Chayav Inish Levesume Adelo Yada Ben Aror Haman LeBaruch Mordechai. That one is required to get intoxicated to the point where they can't tell the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. Okay? So first of all, I mean, there's an already like an agadic, a literary, a poetic expression already there. Why Aror Haman and Baruch Mordechai, right? Why not just say you got to get, you know, so bombed on, you know, on Purim that you don't know your right from your left. You don't know which way is up, which way is down, right? Why Delo Yada Ben Aror Haman and Baruch Mordechai? And then immediately afterwards, There's a story about how Rabbah and Rabbi Zeira had their Purim suited together, and Rabbah got intoxicated and then got violent, and so he accidentally killed Rabbi Zeira. Oops, sorry about that. And then he had to resurrect him, you know, which is pretty cool if he could perform a resurrection while drunk. It doesn't say that he sobered up first, right? And so there's a story, like a somewhat fantastical story, of one rabbi killing another rabbi, which complicates the earlier Gemara. It's like, wait a second, you just said that we have to do this, and then two lines later you're saying, like, oh yeah, by the way, there was this one rabbi who got really, really drunk and killed another guy, and then the next year he invited him for the Seuda again, and he said, no, thank you. So even there, like, you know, where are you going to draw the line between Halakha and Agadah? The Maharsha, you know, he has two commentaries, Chidushei Agadot, Chidushei Halachot, right? His commentary on Agadah, his commentary on Halakha. He addresses that line and this story in both, right? So really this division, this bifurcation that we make between Halakha and Agadah is one of convenience, but it's not one that really exists. We're going to see that it's not just Halakha and Agadah that that's true of. I think most human disciplines are created by convenience, right? It's a way that that most people organize data. But the corpus of information doesn't have such rigid boundaries between various bodies of knowledge, various subjects of knowledge, various disciplines, and that's something that we're going to return to very soon. Okay. So the first Gemara, again, it's in a halachic context. The Gemara is discussing a halachic requirement. In this case, the father's requirement, specifically the father's requirement, right? It's a Gemara that talks about a father's requirement to teach his son Torah. Okay? And by the way, it tells us a story. Okay, Tanu Rabbanan. The rabbis taught, so we start with an apodictic statement, a statement of straight law. Hu lilmod uv no lilmod. Father and the son both need to learn, both need to study. Hu kodem livno. The father takes precedence over the son, right? If neither the father nor the son has a Jewish education, the father goes and gets an education over the son, right? A person's obligation toward himself takes precedence over his obligation toward anyone else. Rabbi Yehuda complicates this a little bit. Rabbi Yehuda introduces a subjective human element. It says, "Im b'no zariz u'mulach v'talmudo mitkayem b'yado." If the son is particularly energetic, right? He's excited about it, right? And he shows a certain subtlety of wit, subtlety of reasoning, and he remembers what he learned. B'no kodmo, then the son takes precedence, right? If the son is more potential than the father, the son takes precedence. Okay? That's the end of the Braita's statement, right? That's the end of the Hebrew. Now we shift to Aramaic. The Gemara is bringing a story to support, right, in support of or in corroboration with this first statement. Okay? Ki hadar of Yaakov, breder of Achabar Yaakov. Like the story of Rabbi Yaakov, the son of Rabbi Achabar Yaakov. What happened? Shadrei avu elikameh d'abaye. His son sent him to learn with Abaye. Kiata, he came to visit his son in yeshiva, chazyeh delohava mechadad and shmaateh. He saw that he wasn't, you know, his learning wasn't sharp. He wasn't learning well. Amar leh, he said, ana adif minachs. I'm better me than you, right? So the assumption is that Yaakov, the son, is, you know, he was a talented kid, because based on the Braita, if he wasn't a talented kid, he shouldn't have taken precedence over his father, right? He was a talented kid, but he went to yeshiva, and it just wasn't working out. So the father's like, you know what? You go, you work, and, you know, I'm going to go to yeshiva. You support me for a change. Tuv at, you go home to Ezel Anna. I'm going to go to yeshiva instead. So Shama Abaye de Kahava Adi. Shama Abaye heard that Rav Acha bar Yaakov is coming. He's like, wow, great sage coming to study in my yeshiva. What an opportunity. Oh, and there's this little problem we have to take care of. What's that? Havahahu mazik bei Rabbanan da Abaye. In Abaye's yeshiva, there was a mazik, a demonic force, a harmful, a destroyer, a damager, right? Something was causing trouble, right? It was a haunted Beit Midrash. D'chi havu aili betrain, when two people would go into that Beit Midrash, chavruta, afilu biyamama, even during the day, which is a time that, you know, demons don't usually hold much sway, havu mitziki, they were being harmed, they were being hurt. So Amar Lahu, right? So these chavrutot, right? People were trying to learn together, and all of a sudden they were being harmed by this demon. Amar Lahu, so Abaye said to his people, Lo leitiv le inish ushpiza. Nobody give him lodgings, nobody offer to host him. Efter dimitrachash nisa, maybe a miracle will happen. So he gets there. He doesn't get an invitation. No choice. He's going to sleep in the Beit Midrash. Oh, but bahahu be rabbanon, right? He went and he took up lodging in that Beit Midrash. So he's there. He's lying down at night, about to go to sleep, and all of a sudden, here comes our demon. Okay, it appeared to him, kitanina deshiva reshvate. It appeared to him as a serpent with seven heads. So he did what I think many of us would do in such a situation. He prayed. Kol kriya dekara, every time he bowed down in prayer, natar chad reshe, one of its heads fell off. Neat trick. Amar lehu lemachar, the next day, he said to them, ilo itrachash nisa sakintin, had this miracle not happened, that all of its heads fell off, and unlike the Hydra, every time a head fell off, two did not grow in its place. Sakintin, you would have put me in harm's way, right? You put me in danger. I was in danger. Okay, so a strange story, a very strange story that starts off normal enough about a father and a son, and the son not having so much success studying in yeshiva. And the father saying, you know what, I'm going to go to yeshiva instead. Somebody should get some learning done. And then all of a sudden, there's this seven-headed monster haunting the Beit Midrash that they don't really, at the end of the Gemara, have a solution for, right? What are we supposed to do with this seven-headed monster? I don't know. He killed it. Is it going to come back the next day? I don't know. It was miraculous. Everybody thinks it's miraculous. Rabbi says, maybe a miracle will happen. And at the end, he says, if not for that miracle, I would have been in danger. So let's think for a second about the situation, right? Talented kid, Yaakov. His father sends him to yeshiva. It's not working out. Not only is the problem with Yaakov, but you know, it's not only Yaakov that's not getting much learning done. It's nobody in the yeshiva that's getting much learning done. Anytime, two guys try to sit down, learn afternoon Seder, all of a sudden there's this monster that's coming, this demon that's coming, and is distracting them from their learning. Right? And we finally meet this demon, and it takes the form of a monster, of a serpent, that has seven heads. Okay. What do we know about Abaye? You know, is this a normal thing? Right? Why would he... I mean, the way that I picture this is that Abaye... Rav Acha Breder of Yaakov has this son, Yaakov. This is not the first yeshiva that he sent his son to. On one hand, the kid is so bright. The kid is clearly talented. He can really accomplish a lot, but no yeshiva seems to be able to handle him. Right? Everywhere he goes, he's not successful. He's goofing off. He's doing whatever. It can't get through to him. He hears about this other yeshiva, Abaye's yeshiva. Maybe Abaye will have success with him. This is a last-ditch effort. Right? This is the last chance. And it, too, doesn't work out. And he's like, okay, forget it. Go home. Go get a job. I don't know. What was Abaye trying to do? Okay. So we do know some, again, I don't want to talk about history, the history of Abaye. I don't know if, you know, Abaye was a figure. The Talmud, the Gemara, tells stories about Abaye. So I assume that there's a certain consistency of, you know, the degree to which that that image that emerges from the Gemara is is an accurate depiction of the historical Abaye, I think it's an irrelevant question. Okay? We have no access to the historical Abaye. We don't have Abaye's diary. We don't have Abaye's Facebook page. We don't have access to the historical Abaye. All we have is the stories that the Gemara reports in Abaye's name, tells us about Abaye, the halachic positions that we know about Abaye. But we can assume that the Gemara, right, the Talmud that quotes Abaye in all these different places, right, has some sort of consistent, integral view of who Abaye was. Okay, and that's our starting point. So when a different Gemara talks about Abaye, you know, I think it's fair to look at that Gemara and look at this Gemara and, you know, try to map out some sort of consistency of character. Okay, so this second Gemara, it's a real short Gemara. It, too, is in a halachic context initially. It's talking about at what age can a young man be included in a zimun. Right? And so the Gemara says that when they're old enough to know who we pray to, they can be included in a zimun. Okay? Ashkenazim don't rule that way in practice. Sephardim do. But for our purposes, that's neither here nor there. The Gemara then introduces a story. Abaye and Rava, who were both orphans, Havuyatu Kame de Rabba, they were sitting before their adopted father, Rabba, same Rabba who used to kill people at his Sephardim Suda. Omar Luhu Rabba said to them, Lemim of Archin, who do we daven to? Who do we bless when we say a bracha? Amrile, they said to him, Lirachmana, we pray to the merciful one, God. So he continues his line of interrogation. V'rachmana hechayativ, where does God live? And so apparently Abaye and Rava had never heard of Uncle Maishi, and they didn't say, Hashem is here, Hashem is there, Hashem is truly everywhere. They weren't as theologically sophisticated as Uncle Maishi, apparently. Rather, Rava achve l'shmei talala, Rava pointed to the ceiling, pointed to the rafter beams. Abaye nafak lavra, Abaye ran outside, achli klape shemaya, and he pointed towards the heavens. Amar luhu Rava, Rava, Rava was so taken with their answers, he said, tarvaychu rabbanan havitu, you are both going to grow up to be rabbis. Don't know if that's a blessing or a curse. And hainu da amri inche, and this is, you know, the statement, right? This is what it means when people say, butzin mi katfei adia, right, you can tell how sweet the fruit is going to be by the sweetness of the sap of the sapling. Right, you can tell when somebody's a child what they're going to be like when they get older. Okay, I taught this to a high school class 14, 15 years ago, and I took as a starting point that the Gemara is not just telling us, you know. Yeah, Rava pointed this way, and Abaye ran outside and pointed to the ceiling. That there's something about the personalities of Abaye and Rava that's being expressed in this Gemara, and I didn't think of that by myself. I actually got that from Rav Kook. Rav Kook has a commentary on some of the Agadic sections of the Gemara called Ein Ayah, and that's where I got this. That's where I first got it from. But instead of just reading Ein Ayah to the class, I put the question to them. Okay, let's assume that Rava staying inside the building, pointing to the ceiling, right? That's not just coincidence, right? Abaye running outside and Rava staying in the building, that tells us something about Abaye and Rava, okay? What does it tell us? You know, I posed this question to the class. This was, I think, 9th and 10th graders. I got some really fun answers. You know, one was, yeah, Abaye is modern Orthodox, and Rava is Haredi, because Abaye is more worldly, he's out there, and Rava, he's just sitting in yeshiva, okay? Another kid said, yeah, Rava is Orthodox, Abaye is Reform. You know, all kinds of things like that. Some of the more clever ones, you know, Rava is more like the halachic man of Rav Soloveitchik, whereas Abaye is a little bit like more broad-minded, like Rav Kook. And it's interesting because Rav Kook actually, that's very similar to what Rav Kook himself actually says, which is that's the fourth source in the sheet. I read Rav Kook's, I think it's pretty clear that Rav Kook's description of Abaye is autobiographical. Okay? So he says, Al kein Rava achve l'shmei t'lala. This is why Rava pointed to the ceiling. Why? Ki etana tiyato el shkidat ha-Torah. His influence, or his tendency was diligence. Udrishat kol ha-emet. And he wanted to get to all the truth befirtehem ha-mugbalim in their very precisely defined details. Uvezeh yavo l'hakarat kono yitbarach. That was where he found God. Right? That was the question we started with. Where do you find God? Where is God? Not where is God? Right? And that answer is, Rav Kook is implicitly saying, also somewhat subjective. People find God in different places. Rava finds God in structure. Rava finds God in detail. V'zot ha'netiyah mashla b'nafsho gam bi'aldut. Right? And that was his tendency even when he was a kid. L'mtso menucha gam kein b'tzela ohel. He found rest in the tent. V'ze yavo el menucha. Right, so he repeats that word menucha, which I think is going to be really—it's a key word. Right, this is how he finds menucha, v'hatu'uda haromema, and this higher consciousness. But Abaye is different. Sha'af el harchavat hayidia b'hakara pnimit shemitnaseit el limala mikol gvul. Abaye strove toward a breadth of knowledge. Right, through an inner recognition that goes beyond all limits. Right, he didn't try to find truth in detail. He tried to find truth in things that were above, that were not limited, that were not, that didn't have boundaries. Okay, v'dachako tiv'o, he was driven by his nature. Dachak, right? He's driven by his nature. But tivoat pnimi, by his inner nature, by his psychological makeup, levatei rigashot nafsho berachmana hechayativ al yedei denafak lavra. Right. So the way he was made up psychologically when he was asked the question, "Where is God?" This idea that he ran outside expresses his inner makeup. Right. He finds God in the infinite, in the expanse. Okay. And he points to the heavens, El Merchav in Kates, to the boundless space. Okay? And then he says, reflectively, Rav Kook continues, Yuchal yod shemisha holech al derech ha-chuchma ha-mugbelet hu yoter karov la-chuchma ha-ma'asit. Rav Kook understood that he wasn't regarded as a posek, right? He was a posek, right? He issued halachic rulings. He says that, you know what, it could be that somebody that has this breadth of knowledge that's more focused on the beyond doesn't really always get down to the details, doesn't necessarily get to the practical. It's more, you know, he's not focused on the details, right? So al kein le'inyan halacha yachol liyot mikevan mechuvan yoter shtiyah halacha kmoto. So it could be that, yeah, this is why the halacha is always like Rava, right? Except for six places in all of Shas, we follow Rava and not Abaye. Right? So it could be maybe, Rav Kook is saying, maybe that's why. Okay? The key word that I said was, I said that a key word would be menucha, right? Rav Kook says twice when describing Rava that in the tent where he's studying these details, he finds menucha. He finds rest. He finds respite. His soul is calm and serene. He doesn't use that word when describing Abaye. Abaye, he's talking about how Abaye is driven. Abaye has, you know, this impulse that he's expressing, and it's expressed by him running outside, right? And if we're going to give if Rava is characterized by this rest, by this being at ease, at rest, then Abaye is restless. Okay? He has no rest. He can't rest. He doesn't have that inner calm, right? He actually has that inner drive, that inner constant motion. Okay? There's one other point. Rav Kook actually brings it up. I didn't quote the entire, it's a long passage. Abaye and Rava, they were both orphans, and they were both from a family that was known for its lack of longevity. They were both from the family of Eli HaKohen, which in Sefer Shmuel, that family was cursed, that all the males in that family were cursed to die prematurely. But the Gemara says that because, right, in the merit of his Torah, Rava lived longer than most of the men in the family. He actually made it to the age of 40, which is kind of frightening for me. That's exactly my age, and I haven't accomplished anything near what Rava accomplished in his short years. So it's, you know, but Rava, right, the great hero of the Gemara, he didn't have a long life. Passed away at age 40. Abaye, on the other hand, he lived a little bit longer. He lived till the age of 60. The Gemara explains that the merit that Abaye had that enabled him to live longer was that he combined Torah study with gemilut chasadim, with acts of kindness. Okay, so those three, now three data points, right? Abaye, if Rava represents Torah only, then Abaye represents Torah combined with acts of kindness, right? A life of, you know, philanthropy. Rava finds his place of rest within the Beit Midrash, whereas Abaye is restless. Abaye runs out. He needs breadth. He needs beyond. He needs expanse. He can't be confined in that structure. Returning to the Gemara with which we started, Abaye then builds a yeshiva. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to suggest that Abaye's yeshiva was geared towards students like Abaye. It was attracting kids who were like Abaye himself, kids who were restless, kids who sort of went out of the literal box, right, of the Beit Midrash, out of the classroom, and who were trying to combine their Torah with other things, right, who wanted to do other things in addition to Torah, to study Torah. And it wasn't working. The students weren't having success. They were distracted by a haunted Beit Midrash. They couldn't succeed there. We ask, what was the problem? Right? Why couldn't Abaye get through to these kids? Abaye successfully merged his life of Torah with his life of Gemilut Chasadim. Why couldn't his students do the same thing? Why couldn't Abaye create a curriculum that would give the kids Torah and Gemilut Chasadim, and that would enable them to find success, to become Abaye-like? So I think that the key to understanding or to diagnosing what's going on in Abaye's Beit Midrash is that, I mean, when you look at that Gemara, the thing that really, really leaps out at us, I mean, hopefully not literally, but at least figuratively, is the seven-headed snake. It leapt out at Rav Acha bar Yaakov. Literally, it leaps out at us, figuratively. What's it doing there? So the Maharal, in his commentary on the Agadah here, which is the second source in front of you, he explains what this serpent represents. Now, seven-headed serpents come up all over the place. I alluded to the Hydra before, but it's not just there. It comes up in Aztec and Inca culture. It's in the Book of Revelations. You know, it's a venerable beast. It's the seven-headed monsters come up in all sorts of different cultures, all sorts of different mythologies. Is there a seven-headed monster in Harry Potter? Three-headed. Okay. The Cerberus? Dog, the three-headed dog? Yeah, okay. But no seven-headed snakes. All right. So what's a seven-headed monster represent? Right? In all of these things, they're always demonic forces. They're always forces of chaos. Right? They're always the beasts that the gods have to slay in order to bring order to the universe. right? Or in order to bring, you know, to overcome the forces of chaos, right? The Maharal actually says something similar. It says, Daki hashiva timtza tamid al mispar haribui. Seven is a number that connotes multiplicity. Six directions plus the center is seven. 7 days of the week. And Maharal sees a tremendous amount of significance in numbers in general. A lot of his commentaries, you know, he writes about the significance of what numbers symbolize. So seven, he says, always represents multiplicity. Right? V'hashedim, demons, kocham hariboy. They draw their power from multiplicity. Right? There's this long page after page in Psachim where the Gemara talks about all these superstitions about the number that are related to the number two, right? And how two is almost like it conducts demonic forces, right? So stay away from anything that has to do with even numbers. Okay, why? Because hem hefecha achdut, right? They're the opposite of unity, right? There's no unity here, right? There's no, you know, there's separation. There's diffusion. There's dispersal. Ve'im sholtim al zugot davka, and that's why they specifically have control over things that are multiple, things that are even numbered. Okay. Now, if you were to ask me, I don't think this is what the Maharal is saying exactly, but if you were to ask me, I think a seven-headed snake is an apt metaphor for ADHD. Why do I say that? The experience will often be one where you're almost literally, your mind is divided, your attention is divided, right? You can't, you know, the lack of focus in one area, it's not lack of focus per se, but it's an attempt to focus on two things at the same time. And it's, you're being pulled in several directions at the same time, right? It's, you know, if the opposite, when somebody, the opposite would be when somebody is able to really focus, really give attention to only one thing. And we say that such a person is single-minded, right? Single-minded pursuit, single-minded devotion. So if that's the case, then the opposite of single-minded is multiple-minded, right? And I think that that's, I think that the seven heads of the beast is an apt metaphor for that, right? It's something that haunts. It's something that distracts. And it's something that it's literally, it's dividing your head. It's dividing your mind, okay? What's the antidote? What's the antidote to it? How do you overcome it? Well, the Gemara doesn't really offer much in the way of a solution, right? It says it was a nes, right? He davened, right? Maybe davening. I don't know if davening can do it. I mean, I would think that in general, something that somebody feels, you know, somebody that has ADD, if they feel very passionate about something, they can hyper focus on it. And you hyper focus, yes, you can really, but that doesn't happen. You can't control that, right? It's a nes when that happens, right? Lo b'chol yoma itrachesh nisa. Miracles don't happen every day, okay? So it's not a solution, right? You can't turn that on and off at will. So that leaves us asking the question, okay, so where, what do we do? Where do we go? I'm going to take this even a step further. This is not just about ADD. Abaye was trying to synthesize Torah study with Gmilut Chasadim, right? A life of the mind with a life of action, which is it's a great goal, but that too doesn't always work, because when we value many, many things, it's hard to generate any passion about one specific thing, okay? And, you know, we look at our, you know, the way we structure our educational institutions, the way we structure our schools, there's a, you know, we're they're divided, right? You have biology, close your biology textbooks. Now you're going to open up your chumashim. You're going to close your chumashim, and you're going to open up your math textbooks. You're going to close your math textbooks. You're going to open up your Gemara, right? That we have divided our sources of knowledge into disciplines, into distinct disciplines. And we, you know, when there's one student whose mind doesn't quite work, whose mind is undisciplined, and I mean that in two senses. The mind is undisciplined in that he can't control where he puts his focus. He can't control what, you know, can't just focus on what the teacher is talking about. But that's often because his mind is undisciplined, right? He doesn't think in categories of disciplines. She doesn't think of math as just math and biology as just biology and Chumash as just Chumash. Everything's always, you know, bleeding into the other subjects, right? There is no distinct subject. There are no distinct disciplines. And I think that that's more true of the world around us. The world around us doesn't respond. I mean, you can't just look at one disciplinary through one disciplinary lens. The world around us is complicated. The way that we function is a combination of all these different elements. The world that we live in is a combination of all these different elements. And, you know, when we try to split everything out and, like, focus on just this corpus of knowledge or just that corpus of knowledge, sure, there are instances in which we really want to just focus on that, but much of life doesn't work like that. Much of life is not disciplined in that way. Doesn't work in that sort of disciplinary way. And so it's not just a question of students with ADHD, it's a question of, in general, like, how do we create educational institutions that, on one hand, we want our pupils, we want our children to be well-rounded, we want them to be able to, you know, understand and appreciate, the breadth of human knowledge, but at the same time, we also want to instill passion. We want to imbue them with a sense of, you know, that they want to learn, they want to grow intellectually and morally, and they want to delve into that corpus of knowledge. And it's a challenge, right? And I think that that's also part of the challenge of Abaye's yeshiva. Abaye, he wants to generate passion for both Torah and Gemilut Chasadim. How do you do that? Once you divide it, right, division is also diffusion. You can't be passionate about all those things. You can't be passionate about everything. Okay? So there's where Abaye leaves us. That's where the story of Abaye leaves us, with a question. And now, I mean, this is it may seem somewhat presumptuous to say that if the Gemara didn't offer an answer to this question, that, you know, I think I might have one, and the one that I might have, I don't know how implementable it is on the broad scale, but we can give it a try. You think about a seven-headed monster, right? It's a tail, a body, and then at the top it branches into seven heads. It sort of reminds us of another very, very famous Jewish symbol. Yeah, menorah, right? Which we just read about this past week's Parsha. Well, the menorah had some interesting properties, right? Seven branches, but it had to be miksha achat, right? It had to be carved or sculpted from a single piece of... it had to be sculpted from a single piece of gold, right? A single kikar of gold, okay? Now, take a look on the second page, the second to last source. This is the Netziv describing the menorah. The menorah, in almost all, like throughout Jewish, in all of Jewish texts, it represents wisdom, right? Light, illumination, enlightenment. It was on the south side of the Mishkan, and Harotzeh Lahachkim Yadrim, right? You face toward the south if you want to attain wisdom. So HaMenorah Bechlal, right? The Netziv tells us, he summarizes, he didn't come up with this. It says, "Bechlal miramezet lahair al chuchmata shel haTorah." Right? It represents the wisdom of the Torah. That's what menorah is. The different aspects of it: bepilpul v'chakira v'iyun. Right? The the casuistry of the Torah, and the investigation and the contemplation, right, that's all symbolized by the menorah. It's all alluded to in the menorah. Shisha kineh ha-menorah, the six side branches of the menorah, three on each side, im ha-kaneh ha-emtza'i, plus the central branch of the menorah, hema zayin chochmot chitzoniyot ha-tfeilin la-Torah. Those are the seven branches of wisdom that are secondary to the Torah. Okay, so again, the number seven, again, represents, like we saw in Maharal, represents multiplicity. But here, it's talking about the multiplicity, right? The entirety of human knowledge, all human knowledge, right? These seven branches represent the seven key disciplines, the seven highest disciplines of human knowledge. Okay. Torah, now he starts getting interesting. Shatorah tzricha lahem lehitparesh. The Torah requires them in order to be explained, meaning you can't understand the Torah unless you've also mastered these disciplines. Okay. The Torah doesn't stand alone. The Torah requires these other disciplines. You need to know other things. You can't understand Eruvin or Mikvaot unless you can't understand Rosh Hashanah, unless you understand astronomy. Fine. And then he continues, and he says, well, we're talking about seven disciplines, but they're not really distinct. On the menorah, on each branch of the menorah, there were these decorative cups. What do they mean? Shahatorah mashka b'chokhmot, v'chokhmot mashkim hadat lahavin diktuke dvar Hashem. They all spill over into each other. The Torah spills over into other branches of knowledge. Other branches of knowledge spill over into Torah. You can't really take a scalpel and say, okay, this is where Torah ends and where astronomy or geometry or anatomy or physics or chemistry begins, right? All of those are necessary for Torah. Torah is necessary for... There's no clean break. There's spillover. One spills over into the next. Umeshukadim, and there are also these decorative almonds, right? An almond decoration on the menorah. What does that mean? Shekolze enuba ela al yedei shkida, right? There's no mastery without real investment, without real diligence. Okay. V'yesh toelet miyuchedet al yedei shkida dafka lo'ota chokhma v'lo zulata, right? And there is a specific purpose why we put our diligence in one wisdom, one branch of wisdom, that is the Torah, and not in anything else. That's why the Torah says that one kana, that one branch, meaning the central branch, is Torah. So what is he saying? What's his, if we're going to conceptualize his theory of knowledge and learning and education based on this passage, what he's saying is, first of all, you're talking about one piece. Everything's of a piece. And even when they branch out, there's spillover. One spills over into the next. But how do you attain mastery? You don't attain mastery by attempting to master seven distinct branches, right? You attain mastery by focusing, by generating passion for one branch, the central branch. For him, it's Torah. Meaning, he's saying, let's conceive of knowledge not as seven books in a row on a shelf, but as a web, right? An interconnected web of knowledge, right? And sometimes things are connected to things, to things that are similar, and sometimes things are connected to things that would seem very dissimilar, right? You're talking about a neural network of human knowledge, right? So there might be a cluster of nodes in one area that we can call mathematics. And there might be a cluster of nodes in another area that we can call Mishnah. But there are going to be connections between those two nodes, between math and Mishnah, right? So any attempt to say, okay, this is math and this is Mishnah and we're going to divide them, it falls short, right? It's an artificial division to an extent. So if it's a web has no beginning, a web has no end. It's like a circle, right? You can pick any point on a circle, and that can be your starting point. Okay? So he's saying that as a matter of principle, as a matter of this is how we need to teach, this is how we need to learn, this is how we need to train ourselves, we have to pick a point. And that point has to be our starting point, right? And it's from that starting point where we're going to, that's where we're going to focus our drive, that's where we're going to focus our passion, okay? And that starting point for us, that's the Torah, that has to be the Torah. But where you go from there, there's no right direction, there's no wrong direction. It branches out in seven different directions. It can branch out infinitely, right? You start by generating passion for Torah, right? But passion for Torah itself can grow and develop into multiple branches. Right? It doesn't have to stay there, right? The Torah is not defined narrowly here. The Netziv is defining Torah as anything but narrowly. The Torah requires all these things. So you might start learning the Mishnah, right? And you get to a Mishnah and there's something, you need math or you need history or you need something to understand this Mishnah. So it takes you in that direction and you go in that direction and that's the way you move, right? And you might pick up other disciplines along the way. You might acquire other smaller corpuses of human knowledge along the way. I like to finish with this short passage from Rav Aaron Lichtenstein for two reasons. Number one, because I think that he says it really concisely and really, really well. And also because I think that Rav Lichtenstein, I'm sure almost everybody in this room has heard of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. And I think that he's often misunderstood. Right? You hear people talk about Rav Lichtenstein and they'll say, yes, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, he was a great Rosh Yeshiva and a Gadol Hador. Plus, he also had a PhD in English literature from Harvard, right? Meaning he had mastered two fields. He had achieved mastery in two completely disparate areas. Right? And and we hold him up as a paradigm of Torah Umada, right? That this is somebody who, you know, he had Torah knowledge, and also, as though it's something distinct, he was also a very, you know, well-educated, learned, well-rounded, etc., etc. And I think that that's a fundamental misunderstanding of who he was. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was, if nothing else, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was whole, right? One of the passages from Matthew Arnold that he always used to quote was, you know, who saw life steadily and saw it whole, right? Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was not a bifurcated individual in any way. He was not. There were no two sides of him. There was one side. It was an incredibly complex side, but it was one side. He has this article, calls it Centrist Orthodoxy of Spiritual Accounting, right? And one of the things that he does there is he critiques centrist Orthodox education. And he says that by studying multiple disciplines, we're giving up on, you know, what we might accomplish had we focused on Torah only, right? Now, I think that his solution is similar to what the Netziv was suggesting, but the way he says it, he says, diffusion does inevitably some measure of dilution. And the pure Torah component within a Torah im derech eretz approach, right? Torah im derech eretz, obviously, is the Torah with some sort of secular studies. We could call it, in Abaye's Yeshiva, the Torah im Gemilut Chasadim approach, this separation, right, this bifurcation, this dual curriculum approach is indeed likely to command less single-minded loyalty. There's that word, right? Single-minded, right? You're not going to be single-minded. You're going to be multi-minded. You're going to be diluted. You're going to be distracted in multiple different directions. Then the unitary goal, right, as we saw in the Maharal, Achdut, right? The unitary goal of Shemen Zayit Zach, of pure olive oil. Now, I don't know if he meant this consciously, but the fact that he used the term Shemen Zayit Zach that relates specifically to the menorah, right, to me, says that, you know, he was thinking along these lines, right? That he was thinking along the lines that we don't want to go the Abaye route of trying to, you know, of being haunted by a seven-headed monster, right? We want to go the menorah route of starting with a basis, starting with a central branch, and allowing that to branch out, okay? When I think of, the different possibilities for education that there are today. Meaning, I tell my kids, look, the way that schools are structured today, the way that their schools are structured, you know, they're in classrooms of 30, 40 kids. I tell them, you know, today's schools, they weren't created for you. They were created on an industrial paradigm where, you know, it was intended to be a Procrustean bed, right? And we've tinkered around the edges, but the fundamental idea that there's a school with rooms, you know, and with a curriculum and with everybody learning the same curriculum, it's not for kids like you. It's just, it's not, I don't know if it's, I can't speak for other people's kids, but I know with my own kids, like, it wasn't for them, right? So I give them the tools, and that includes medication, to get through the day. And then when they get home, like, you know, we start to branch out. That's when we start to, you know, so with whether it's Khan Academy or Code Academy or just the books that they take out of the library and that they read, you know, that's the way that they're, you know, I don't even know where they're going half the time, right? I'll get them interested in something. I'll discuss something with them. They'll get excited about one thing, and, you know, I'll tell them where to look for more about that, and it's off to the races, right? I once thought that my older son might be the first person to ever read the entire Wikipedia. He would just go on there, and he was, like, reading one thing, and he would see a link to something else, and he would start reading that to something else, because Wikipedia, right, with links, it's organized in the way that, you know, you can jump from one to the next, and they're, you know, and those connections between this discipline and that discipline are readily available, right? They're obvious, right? There are hyperlinks, right? So what once upon a time wasn't readily obvious, today it is readily obvious. So I think that, you know, when we talk about ADD and the Beit Midrash, the contributions that Abaye makes, the contributions that today's ADHD students who have ADHD and adults who have ADHD, yes, there are such people, can make, you know, it's specifically by making those connections, by seeing those connections, by showing us that, you know, the way that we try to compartmentalize knowledge, that's not, you know, it's useful, right? And sometimes it's really important to compartmentalize in that way. But at the end of the day, that's artifice, right? That's manufactured. That's the product of human convention. And that we see the world in a more real way, and we make connections that are really there by learning to see the world through the eyes of students like this, who are able to see that, you know, this, you might think it's distinct, but really it's connected to that, and that's connected to that. And we're living in this world that's infinitely more interesting and more complicated, you know, than we might think it is just by looking at, you know, individual branches and compartments of knowledge. So I think that, yeah, at the end of the day, Abaye and his spiritual heirs have a tremendous amount to contribute to the culture of our Beit Midrash and to the culture of our shuls and schools. And, you know, the challenge is, you know, how do we bring that out of that? How do we bring that out of them? How do we put them in a position to succeed and to make those contributions that they can make? You know, and not, God forbid, to, you know, to convey to them that they don't have anything unique to contribute, or that their contributions are unwelcome. Okay, so it's a challenge. Thank you.